This is VOA News. I'm Michael Brown reporting via remote. Hundreds of thousands of demonstrators marched in Myanmar on Thursday, rejecting the army's assertion that the public supported its overthrow of elected leader Aung San Suu Kyi and vowing they would not be cowed in their bid to end military rule. Opponents of the February 1st military coup are deeply skeptical of junta assurances given at a news conference Tuesday that there would be a fair election and it would hand over power, even as police filed an additional charge against Suu Kyi. The UN Secretary General is calling on the world's largest economies to create a task force to plan and coordinate a global COVID-19 vaccination plan. Antonio Guterres told a high-level virtual meeting of the UN Security Council on the global vaccine rollout. The G20 is well placed to establish an emergency task force to prepare such a global vaccination plan and coordinate its implementation and financing. U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken made his international debut at the online meeting. He said the Biden administration will work with partners to expand COVID-19 vaccines, manufacturing and distribution capacity, and increase access, including to marginalized populations. Blinken also said Washington would pay more than $200 million in assessed and current obligations to the WHO by the end of this month. Funding stopped to the organization last year under the Trump administration, which did not like how WHO handled the coronavirus pandemic. As always, for additional information, we invite you to join us at our website. That's voanews.com, also on the VOA mobile app. Via remote, this is VOA News. The latest NASA probe to Mars is set to land Thursday after a journey that began last July. During the landing of Perseverance, NASA has no ability to control the probe. Perseverance is targeting a landing in Jezero Crater, which is believed to be an ancient lake bed. There, it will search for signs of ancient life. NASA has successfully landed 8 of 9 probes on Mars. The United States plans to repair and revitalize cooperation with its European allies, as Washington and Beijing are seen as competing for influence in supporting vaccine distribution and post-pandemic recovery in Europe. U.S. President Joe Biden is set to speak virtually at the Munich Security Conference on Friday. Biden's speech would come after Chinese President Xi Jinping's pledge to boost imports from Central and Eastern European countries into the Chinese market in coming years. Beijing's appeal to European countries came as Washington is shoring up efforts to, as officials described it, revitalize core alliances and return to multilateralism. The U.S. Justice Department charged 3 North Korean computer programmers and a broad range of global hacks, including a scheme to steal more than $1 billion from banks and other financial institutions. John Demers, an assistant attorney general for national security, said North Korea's malicious activities are a global problem requiring global awareness, condemnation, and cooperative disruption with this indictment and related disruptions. He said the United States continues to do its part. According to the indictment, the hackers were part of a conspiracy that attempted to steal more than $1.3 billion in money and cryptocurrency from banks and companies, unleashed a sweeping ransomware campaign, and targeted Sony Pictures Entertainment in 2014 over the Hollywood movie The Interview, which depicted the assassination of North Korean leader Kim Jong-un. Facebook said it's blocking Australians from viewing and sharing news on the platform because of proposed laws in the country to make digital giants pay for journalism. The company said Thursday in a statement that Australian publishers can continue to publish news content on Facebook, but links and posts can't be viewed or shared by Australia's audience. The Australian Parliament is debating a proposed law that would make Google, Facebook make deals to pay for the Australian news. Via remote, I'm Michael Brown, VOA News.
Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm James Mbate in Washington. Today is Thursday, February 18th, and here are some of the stories we are covering. Nigerian President Buhari orders the immediate rescue of later school kidnapping victims.
The president condemned it, and his directive is clear and unequivocal that all of the schoolboys must be brought home safely and without any delay.
We'll have a report on how the kidnapping happened. Ugandan opposition leader Bobi Wine has petitioned the UN Human Rights Office. We'll have an update on the first day of Rwanda's Paul Rusesabagina's trial. Zimbabwe deploys more security to enforce COVID-19 lockdown measures. And South Africa rolls out Johnson & Johnson COVID-19 vaccines.
This day represents a real milestone for us as South Africans, that finally the vaccines are here and they are being administered. And I'd like to invite South Africans to take this up so that we can all be safe.
And Zanzibar's first vice president dies after being hospitalized with COVID-19. Those stories and more are coming up on Daybreak Africa. Nigerian officials say government in military uniforms have kidnapped 27 schoolboys and some teachers in Niger State, central Nigeria. Reports say the kidnappers killed at least one student who tried to escape during the attack, the second in Nigeria in just 2 months. Timothy Obiezu reports from Abuja.
Authorities say the attack occurred at around 2 a.m. local time at the government science secondary school, Kagara. A teacher who escaped the raid at the boarding school for boys said hundreds of gunmen on motorcycles herded many abductees into a nearby forest, and one student was killed in the process. A state government spokesperson said Wednesday that 27 people were kidnapped, dismissing initial claims that hundreds may have been taken. A viral video released shows captives with abductors demanding about $1.4 million as ransom. Nigerian security officials did not respond to requests for an interview, but security expert Kabir Adamu says criminal gangs operating in Nigeria's northwest and central regions are to blame.
It's a kidnap for ransom situation. Where they are able to gather this number of persons, it will be almost easy for them to now take over and then use them to negotiate some form of ransom.
The government secondary school in Kagara, where the attack happened, has about 1,000 students. Authorities are currently profiling the students for further updates. President Muhammadu Buhari has ordered troops with area surveillance to go after the captors and rescue the students, according to a statement released Wednesday by his spokesperson, Garba Shehu. But experts say lack of government control over the crisis-ridden regions is the reason incidents reoccur.
The locations where the schools are vulnerable locations. They are remote locations usually that are close to these ungoverned spaces that exist in Nigeria, where most times these criminals used as haven. Then the school's physical security is almost always very weak, from fencing to sometimes even perimeter walls.
Nigeria's northwest and central regions have been recording growing insecurities, often carried out by criminal gangs known as bandits, kidnapping for ransom. Last December, a similar attack occurred in Katsina State, but more than 300 boys were released 6 days later through negotiations. Timothy Obiezu for VOA News, Abuja.
Nigerian President Muhammadu Buhari has called for the quick and safe rescue of the latest abduction victims in Nigeria. Authorities say 27 students and 3 staff members were kidnapped Wednesday from a government science college in Niger State. One student was reportedly killed while trying to escape. The opposition People's Democratic Party, the PDP, condemned the kidnapping but said the Nigerian government must be proactive and not reactive. Garba Shehu is the senior special assistant to President Buhari on media and publicity. He says no country is immune to criminality and that President Buhari should be judged by his swift responses to challenges as they happen in Nigeria.
The president has been briefed about the incident and that the school had been broken into and some students and staff. The numbers have been given by the state government as being 27 students and about 20 others. So the president condemned it and directed very senior military and security officials to immediately move to the state to go and coordinate the rescue. His directive is clear and unequivocal that all of the schoolboys must be brought home safely and without any delay.
President Buhari recently appointed new service chiefs, but your critics are saying that the federal government has consistently failed to provide security for Nigerians.
They are entitled to their opinions. However, we want President Buhari to be judged fairly. There is no country without crime anywhere in the world. We have our own share, and the president should be judged by the responses to the challenges as they arise. And I think that this that the president has set for this country, immediate responses had followed incidents such as this. This had happened under his watch. 110 girls in Yobe State, they were all recovered except one who unfortunately was denied their release by a Boko Haram terrorist. It has happened more than 300 in Katsina State. All of them brought home safely to their families. So we are not a country without crime. There is criminality, but we want to be judged by how effectively and efficiently we respond to these challenges. And I think that the president is doing exceedingly well dealing with these challenges.
Shehu, it appears the federal government is being reactive instead of proactive in dealing with these kidnappings. I want you to react to what I think a Senate committee has said recently, and that is perhaps the federal government or President Buhari should declare a national state of emergency.
Well, they're entitled to their opinion, as I've always said, and I believe the president would see the statement by the Senate and will act accordingly. It's entirely for him to decide. The government is proactive because there are many incidents about to happen. They have been aborted, dealing with criminals in so many areas. Arrests have been made, prosecutions are being made, and plots are being aborted. So I think that people, when they comment on these things, they should look at the totality of what is going on all across the country. It is not wrong to be reactive, because when it happens, you have to react. But it is also happening that we're aborting a lot of plots that would have turned deadly if they were allowed to happen.
Shehu, thank you so much for your time speaking with us. We do appreciate very much.
Thank you, James. I appreciate it.
Galba Shehu is the Senior Special Assistant to Nigerian President Muhammadu Buhari on Media and Publicity. He was speaking with us from the capital, Abuja. Uganda's opposition National Unity Platform Party has petitioned the UN Human Rights Office over alleged human rights violations and state-inspired abductions. Relatives say their loved ones are still missing after they disappeared in the lead-up to last month's contested election. President Yoweri Museveni, who was re-elected to his sixth term, has called the abduction reports false, saying only terrorists were arrested. Halima Atumani reports from Kampala.
The National Unity Platform Party headquarters was filled Wednesday with relatives of people who have been reported missing before, during, and after the January elections. Crying mothers and former abducted young men narrated their tales amid some tears. Ayebare Halima is a mother of two, including a three-week-old infant. She tells how on January 24th, seven police officers went to her home and arrested her at gunpoint. She was then taken to police headquarters in Naguru, where she was threatened and questioned about the whereabouts of her husband, Kenneth Mukasa Seguya. She says she was pregnant when police officers questioned her. Once they were done, she says they told her to go home, but warned that if they failed to find her husband, they would arrest her instead. She says 3 days later, her husband called and told her he had been arrested. Ayemere says her husband was then brought home and police officers took People Power branded T-shirts, some jackets and red berets. She said they then left and took her husband, and she still doesn't know where he is or even if he's alive. Ayamare says one of the arresting officers gave her a number she could call if she wanted to know where her husband was being taken. When she called, however, the officer who answered then insulted her and warned her never to call the number again. National Unity Platform officials report that more than 300 of their members countrywide remain missing. It is for this reason the party president, Robert Kyagulanyi, better known as Bobi Wine, is petitioning the United Nations Human Rights Office in Kampala. He says it is painful that Ugandans have no local human rights institution that can come to their rescue.
General Museveni feels like Uganda is his compound, Uganda is his property. He has the right to pick and kill anybody at his will. He has the right to torture anybody, to murder anybody, but we say he does not. And that is why we are petitioning the United Nations.
However, President Yoweri Museveni, in a security address on Saturday, said these disappearances are not the culture of the current regime and army leadership. According to Museveni, the heavy deployment ahead of the elections was because he heard of plans by some lawbreakers to stop the elections.
And in the case of Kampala, we also brought a commando unit which had distinguished itself in fighting in Somalia and which had destroyed ADF. It was deployed in the Kampala area. And this group quickly defeated the terrorists who had started operating here. They killed a few who tried to attack them and arrested scores of those lawbreakers.
Heavy security was deployed and roadblocks were set up on the route leading to the UN Human Rights Office in Kampala. Six journalists sustained head injuries after being beaten by military police officers as they camped outside the offices. A UN human rights officer who preferred anonymity, speaking to VOA, said they would not comment about the petition since the cases are confidential. Halima Athmani for VOA News, Kampala.
You're listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voice of America. I'm James Bata in Washington. Today is Thursday, February 18. The trial of Paul Rusesabagina of Rwanda and 20 other suspects started yesterday, Wednesday, in the Rwandan capital, Kigali. Rusesabagina, who was portrayed in the movie Hotel Rwanda because of his humanitarian work during the Rwanda 1994 genocide, is charged with 13 criminal offenses for his alleged connection to the FLN, the militia group that the Rwandan government accuses of terrorism. Here is Anaïs Kaniba, Rusesabagina's daughter, with an update on the first day of her father's trial.
My family and I watched the trial live stream online. We were shocked by what we saw. We were not surprised because this is a sham trial. There are some really disturbing things that we saw, even just in the placing of the court and how the court was. You know, we saw my father arrive with the 20 other co-accused. They were all sitting together with some social distancing. Well, with the social distancing, but there was an issue. None of the accused, including my father, were sitting next to their lawyers throughout the trial. The lawyers were sitting in the back of the court behind the journalists. And this is an explanation and another way to the demonstration that this is a fake trial. Usually, accused are supposed to be next to their lawyers, and the lawyers are supposed to tell them what's going on. Today, the court lasted about 6 hours of debate, in which, unfortunately, it was mostly my father speaking. We didn't hear the other accused. But right now, you know, it was a big debate on some key motions that my father wanted to focus on before the trial begins.
And because going into the trial Wednesday, there were some motions made by your father and his lawyers, particularly over the issue of jurisdiction and others. Were they ever addressed?
Normally, you know, these issues should have been addressed before the trial began, but the judge decided to ignore their request. So that's why they decided to bring it up again in court today in front of the public. And the question of the jurisdiction, you know, is really key to this whole trial as well, in addition to the kidnapping, you know, which everybody knows. And my father and his lawyers are going to continue pushing for the motion, specifically with the jurisdiction. We're going to go also into the kidnapping today. He spoke about the competitive jurisdiction, the kidnapping, all of which the prosecution denies and, you know, believe that it's done right and that they don't see any problem with it. So now it's up to the judge to make a ruling on that. So they decided that they will adjourn the court and they will come back next Friday and the judge will tell them how to decide on this motion.
In terms of legal representation, Anaïs, earlier in the case, your family had expressed concern about representation. Who is representing your dad now? Is he a court-appointed lawyer or?
Good question. So, you know, earlier, one of the challenges that we had is when my father first was brought to Kigali there, they forced government-appointed lawyers on him. And these are the people who were not working in his best interest in all the pre-trial motions. And back then, he couldn't even speak against them. And Manil, you saw that he said incriminating things, which did not make sense. That's because he was working with lawyers from the government, making him say these things. Now, with the support of the U.S. government, the European government, but specifically with the support of the media, telling the world about what's happening, shedding light about this violation of my father's rights, Rwanda decided to allow him to see Gatera Gashabana. So they removed those what I call fake lawyers, which are the government-appointed lawyers, from the case and gave Gatera Gashabana. We have engaged with a team of international lawyers. So we have another lawyer called Kate Gibson, Philippe La Rochelle, and Peter Koharis, who are international human rights lawyers, who are supposed to be also by my father's side today. They were not. The reason why they were not is because they've been denied access to my father.
Anaïs, thank you very much again for updating us on the trial. Thank you. We appreciate it.
Thank you so much, James, for keeping up with my father's story.
Anaïs Kaniba is the daughter of Paul Rusesabagina of Rwanda. She was speaking with us from Washington, D.C. South Africa is rolling out its first Johnson & Johnson COVID-19 vaccines, with President Cyril Ramaphosa getting the first shot alongside health workers. VOA's Anita Powell reports from Johannesburg.
It did not hurt a bit, President Cyril Ramaphosa said Wednesday, shortly after he became one of the first South Africans to receive the hot-off-the-plane coronavirus vaccine at a public clinic in Cape Town's sprawling Khayelitsha Township.
First, I was a bit terrified of this long needle that was going to be embedded into my arm, but it happened so quickly, so easily. It was just a prick on my flesh, and I really did not feel much pain.
68-year-old president did ask the nurse if he could close his eyes before getting the one-dose Johnson & Johnson vaccine in his left arm, just hours after 80,000 doses of this vaccine landed in South Africa. He smiled and laughed as he administered the shot, and the crowd clapped. But seriously, he said, this is a big deal. The first shots will go to frontline health workers at public and private clinics.
This day represents a real milestone for us as South Africans, that finally the vaccines are here and they are being administered. And I was rather pleased that there were five people who were vaccinated before me, and they are health workers. And it was a joy to watch them to see whether anything had happened to them. And gladly, nothing had happened to them. And it means that being vaccinated is a fairly straightforward process. And I'd like to invite South Africans to take this up so that we can all be safe, we can all be healthy.
Wednesday's vaccinations could turn around what has been a disappointing narrative for the continent's viral epicenter. The nation carries the bulk of the continent's cases, with 1.49 million confirmed cases and 48,000 deaths. Earlier this month, South Africa received 1 million doses of the AstraZeneca vaccine. But shortly thereafter, it was followed by the disappointing announcement that a study conducted in South Africa found that this vaccine is not totally effective against the highly contagious variant of the virus that is prevalent in South Africa. Health Minister Zweli Mkhize told local media that another 420,000 doses of the Johnson & Johnson vaccine would land in the next 4 weeks, along with another 20 million doses of the two-shot Pfizer vaccine. In all, the nation plans to inoculate 40 million people, about 67% of the population. Anita Powell, VOA News, Johannesburg.
Zimbabwe's public health authorities said the more contagious COVID-19 variant, first spotted in South Africa, now accounts for 61% of the country's new cases. Public health experts fear the variant could overwhelm Zimbabwe's collapsed healthcare system. As Columbus Mavunga reports from Harare, authorities have deployed more security to enforce the country's lockdown measures, but rights groups say the tighter controls will lead to more suffering and abuse.
Zimbabwean Information Minister Monica Mtswangwa told reporters late Tuesday they would tighten lockdown enforcement because the variant had become more common.
Results of the genomic sequencing recently conducted indicated the disappearance of the type of COVID-19 virus that the nation had in 2020. There is now a 61% dominance of the new South African variant of the COVID-19 virus, which spreads faster and has a higher fatality rate. Accordingly, the nation now needs to be more vigilant than before and adhere to COVID-19 prevention and control measures. Our security personnel have therefore been directed to intensify monitoring and enforcement in order to enhance compliance.
While the claim of a higher fatality rate of the variant first spotted in South Africa is contested, it has been proven to be more contagious. Zimbabwe shares a border with South Africa, which authorities say helped the virus and the variant to spread. While international health authorities are urging countries to heed COVID-19 measures, rights groups say some countries like Zimbabwe are using the restrictions to silence opposition. The head of Human Rights Watch in Southern Africa, Dewama Vinga, says Zimbabwe's government should instead focus on helping those in need.
The government needs to step in and support citizens who are in need and who are at risk of starvation. That the government is intensifying the enforcement of regulations by the security forces is in itself not a solution, because we have seen previously that the government has used COVID-19 regulations as an excuse to crack down on government critics and opponents, and this is what is continuing. So there is need for the government to ensure that there is no excessive use of force by the security forces as they monitor the lockdown. People should not be arrested and detained. Places of detention themselves are already overcrowded and present a huge risk for the rapid spread of COVID-19.
If the variant spread is not brought under control, Zimbabwe's public health experts say it could quickly overwhelm the country's hospitals. Zimbabwe's government says once enough vaccine doses are acquired, it plans to eventually immunize 60% of the country's estimated 14 million people in an effort to achieve herd immunity. Columbus Mavunga for VOA News, Harare.
The first vice president of Tanzania's Zanzibar Island died Wednesday morning after announcing he was hospitalized with COVID-19. President John Magufuli, who claims there is no coronavirus in Tanzania despite mounting evidence, issued condolences without mentioning the cause of the vice president's death. Charles Kumbe reports from Dar es Salaam.
Announcing the death Wednesday, Zanzibar's President Hussein Mwinyi said he had learned with great sadness of the passing of Saif Sharif Hamad, a prominent politician who was also the chairman of the Alliance for Change and Transparency Party.
Kwa niaba ya wananchi, nachukua fursa hii kutoa pole na salamu zangu za rambirambi.
On behalf of the people of Zanzibar, I take this opportunity to pass my condolences to the family, relatives, Alliance for Change and Transparency Party, and to all the people of Zanzibar, and ask them to stay calm during this mourning period, announced Mwinyi. He asked that the country has lost a patriotic and outstanding leader. Mwinyi declared 7 days of a national mourning and said flags will be flown at half staff. The cause of death has not been made public, but on January 31, Hamad was hospitalized in the archipelago after testing positive for COVID-19. He became the first person to declare his COVID-19 status in Tanzania since April 29, 2020, as authorities dismissed the idea the virus was present in the country. On a Twitter post, Tanzania's President John Magufuli sent his condolences to the Zanzibar's president and the people of Zanzibar, saying he was saddened by Hamadi's passing. I have received with profound shock the news of the death of Honorable Maalim Seif Sharif Hamad, the first vice president of Zanzibar, the message says. He also sends his condolences to the president of Zanzibar, Honorable Dr. Mwinyi, family, Zanzibaris, Wazalendo members, and all Tanzanians. Hamad was challenging Mwinyi in the October polls in the election that opposition claims was full of fraud. In December, Hamad was sworn in as the first vice president of Zanzibar as part of a unit government. As COVID-19 information in the country is still unclear, the big question is whether the government will reveal the cause of his death. Charles Kombe for VOA News, Dar es Salaam, Tanzania.
And that's it for this Thursday, February 18th edition of Daybreak Africa. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa crew, producer Nicole Beckford, reporters Peter Clotty and Ricky Stryak, as well as sports editor Samson O'Malley, along with all of our engineers, I'm James Barton in Washington, wishing that your day will